Welcome to Sustainability Steps, where we dive deep into important discussions regarding global sustainability. We are your hosts, Ishan Bharadwaj
Ishan Akula.
and Shrey Agarwal.
Tune in every month where we will be joined by experts engaging in discussions about worldwide issues, sustainability efforts, and solutions, and inspiring initiatives aimed at creating a more sustainable future for our planet and the people in it. Whether you're deeply passionate about sustainability or just starting to explore how you can make a difference for our planet, our podcast is here for you. We dive into engaging conversations and offer practical tips to help you along your own journey towards a greener, more sustainable lifestyle. Enjoy.
Today we are joined with Mr. Brock Dickinson.
So to start off, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure, and let me start by saying it's a real pleasure to be on the podcast today. I appreciate the chance to kind of, chat with you and sort of share some ideas. I'm what they call the entrepreneur in residence at the University of Waterloo in Canada, and I'm based in the Faculty of Environment. And sort of part of the idea behind my role is that I'm to work with students who have ideas, proposals for clean tech or green or environmental startups, so small businesses that they're looking to start in the green space. And this kind of builds on a long career that I've had in the sustainability area. I actually, when I finished my university studies, I started working at the United Nations. I was with the UN Environment Program for about 6 years and worked in about 30 countries around the world. And that was in the very early days of sort of figuring out what sustainable development was. My job sort of culminated in the Earth Summit down in Brazil in the early 90s. And that Earth Summit laid the groundwork for everything that sort of followed on the sustainability front at the United Nations, things like the Millennium Development Goals and now the Sustainable Development Goals. And over the years, even though I left the UN and came back to Canada, I've sort of stayed working in that environmental entrepreneurship space. And now I have this opportunity through a university to work with young people all around the world who are exploring ideas around green entrepreneurship and trying to use entrepreneurship as a way to solve some of our environmental challenges.
Yeah, so when did you realize that this was like sustainability was kind of a field you're interested in, you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't start out as, sort of an environmental activist. I did my undergraduate studies at the University of North Carolina, down in Chapel Hill. So, when I got down there, I was really interested in a lot of the international development organizations. I can remember one of the very first groups that I joined was called the Overseas Development Network. And we were trying to raise money for a farmers cooperative in Zimbabwe in Southern Africa. And just the notion that as students that we could do something that was useful and meaningful to people half a world away was really interesting. So I got super engaged in this notion of development. How do I help improve the lives of people who might be facing challenges in other places? They might be confronting poverty or lack of opportunity or repressive governments or things like that. And it was through that kind of work that I started to see more and more that sometimes the barrier for people's growth and development and the ability to pursue new opportunities was not political or economic. It was often environmental. We were just starting to talk about things like climate change and deforestation and desertification. So I got introduced to environmental issues through that back door. And part of my thinking was, well, if a student sitting in North Carolina can make a difference for a farmer in Zimbabwe, in one way, maybe some of these environmental challenges aren't impossible to think about addressing as well. And there's things that we could be doing as young people, as young activists on that front. And that's how it sort of started out. And now I'm, here I am 30 years later. I'm not so young anymore, but I still think that there are opportunities for everyone as individuals, but for young people in particular to kind of have an impact on these big global issues.
So you mentioned that you work with the UN and its environmental program. So obviously you were involved with the SDGs. So what do you think is the current state of awareness regarding the SDGs and what actions are being taken?
Yeah, I think there's some interesting aspects to that question that part of it is, having been around the edges of the UN space for 30 plus years is that, things have changed a little bit over time. when I think back to the very early days of the work that I was doing, we were just trying to kind of help people understand what sustainability was. This was a brand new idea. The UN actually came up with the concept of sustainable development in 1986, so a little bit before I got involved. But you know, back then, education was a big part of helping people understand what these issues were about, and I think that's still the case. You know, the discussion of sustainability led in the year 2000 to the creation of the Millennium Development Goals, which were these sort of set of globally agreed goals that countries around the world said they were going to work on. And when the timeline on that project expired, then we got the Sustainable Development Goals. But there's always been this kind of process of changing ideas, but talking about the various things that we should be working on as a global community. To me, the big piece of that is that we're still working on the education side because awareness around these issues isn't great. I think sometimes people get told about the Sustainable Development Goals and they feel a little guilty for not knowing more about it. But the reality is, you know, we've done survey work globally. It says that, you know, maybe 1% of the people surveyed around the world kind of have a sense of what the Sustainable Development Goals are. The number who say they've heard about them is a little bit higher, but they don't necessarily know what they are. So if only 1% really has a good grasp on this, it means that there's 99% of people who are still trying to figure out the details and you know, get a bit of a better understanding. And you know, that's not evenly spread. I saw a survey that suggested 11% of Canadians, because I live in Canada, 11% of Canadians knew what the Sustainable Development Goals were. I always imagined that probably half of that number was lying or making it up, sort of thing. And I do think that that's one of the challenges, is sort of helping people know what the SDG are, the SDGs are, helping them know that these things exist, and then helping them understand a little bit about what they are too, because I think everybody sort of looks at these, you know, these impressive graphics of the 17 Sustainable Development Goals, and they look at things like, oh, life on land, or you know, no poverty, or some of these sorts of goals, and I think everybody sort of says, okay, I get it. There are these big sort of fancy things that we should all be concerned about, but a lot of people don't sort of take the next step of thinking about the targets. And the indicators and these sort of the next level of information associated with these goals, which gets to be really specific and starts to, you know, look very, very closely at the specific things that we can be doing around these big grand global goals. So I always use the example, you know, I work in entrepreneurship and green entrepreneurship particularly. So goal 8.3 talks specifically about, you know, the notion of how entrepreneurship can play a role in helping to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. So the 17 goals are great. They're a great marketing tool. They're what we need to sort of be focused on as we explain these things to people. But using those as a doorway to talk about more specific ideas, I think, is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you talked about how there's been a lack of awareness and how there's also been kind of a lack of actual change. So what do you think are the biggest barriers for actual awareness and for people to actually start to implement change?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of barriers. We could probably do a whole series of podcasts on barriers. I think there's this one of the things I've been teaching some of my students lately. There's a sociologist who came out of North Dakota in the 1950s and 60s. His name was Mansour Olson, and he had this theory that small groups are more effective at pushing political change than big groups. And he said, you know, in big groups, if lots and lots of people want something, everybody expects that somebody else is going to make work to make it happen. And when you're in a small group, you realize nobody else will do that work, so you have to do it yourself. And I think this is one of the challenges that's out there. I sort of say, you know, what's the classic example of a big group? Well, who would benefit from changing, from stopping climate change? And the answer is, well, everybody in the world would benefit from that, right? Like, that's a big classic example of a large group. And then I contrast that with in my classes with the fans of Zack Snyder's Justice League movie, right? And the number of people that were sort of super fans of that was a very small group. And I don't know, this is going back in time a few years, but when Zack Snyder was making the Justice League movie, he had to drop out partway through for personal reasons. And a new director came in and finished the movie. And a lot of the fans hated the movie and wanted to have a Zack Snyder version produced. And I think, what's the number of people around the world who get super inspired about a Zack Snyder version of the Justice League movie? Well, it's a pretty small number. But interestingly, that's the example of how Mansur Olson's ideas work, because that small number of Justice League movie fans got together and convinced Warner Brothers to actually make a Zack Snyder cut of the movie, which was then distributed through HBO. But that big number of people who are really concerned about climate change have been able to make less impact. And I think that that tells us a lot about how we're likely to make progress. And part of the answer, I think, is to break these big problems up into smaller pieces, where smaller numbers of people can kind of mobilize themselves and see their connection to a particular issue. And I always say that's why Greta Thunberg was sort of so successful in addressing climate change issues, for example. She didn't say, "Hey, everybody in the world, let's go out and stop this stuff. It's a big issue." She said, "Hey, high school students, let's figure out how we can do something in this space." So she turned the big group of everyone everywhere into a smaller group that was a lot easier to mobilize. And I think that the sustainable development goals are kind of set up really well to do that. To say we're going to solve the world's environment and development challenges is too big an issue and too big a group to try to mobilize at once. But to say something like, "Oh, well, we want to sort of create some projects that address the challenges of life below water," or that we want to sort of think about how we produce green energy, that suddenly we're now talking about the issues in a small group way, and it makes it a lot easier for us to sort of tackle those things. So I think that the SDGs are the perfect avenue or the perfect tool for allowing us to think about these big issues from a small perspective.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. Like, if you just say solve climate change or solve this big problem, like, you can't expect a student that isn't exposed to SDG goals or exposed to sustainability to just make their own project or like realize the situation. So, we know that you yourself are very involved with youth education. So, as a professor and entrepreneur, how do you specifically integrate your experiences from the field into your teaching and mentoring of students, and what specific advice would you offer to aspiring young entrepreneurs interested in environmental education?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Ishan. And part of it for me is I'm not really an academic, right? Like, I'm at a university, but I don't have a PhD. I'm not Dr. Brock or anything like that. I just have this kind of practical experience, and I guess I'm old enough. I've built up enough of it now. The university is inviting me to come and share some of the ideas with the young people that I teach there. I always try to take the lessons out of my own work and sort of say, how can we kind of learn from some of these things and apply these ideas in a bigger way? So I've always been entrepreneurial. I've had a number of companies and startups over the years, many of them in the environmental space. And so I kind of start with those experiences and say, let's look at some of the things that I've done and try to draw some lessons out of that. And that's not to say, hey, I'm the example of what you should do, because a lot of what I talk about are the failures that I've had in the entrepreneurship space. Some of the earliest companies that I started were in things like paper recycling, or glass recycling, or the remediation of mines and mining operations. And those companies, some met with some elements of success, but ultimately didn't work out. But I sort of talk about the point of entrepreneurship in the green space is not to have huge successes, not necessarily to get, rich and wealthy and successful, but to sort of say, I'm learning skills and ideas through this entrepreneurial journey that I can apply to bigger issues out there in the world. And that if I'm really learning those lessons well, ultimately, I will have successes. I will have areas where I can take those lessons and make them click in interesting ways. What's a practical example of that? Well, back in the mid-1990s, I started a company that was looking at taking crushed glass, recycled glass, and trying to find industrial uses for that glass. So how do we take it out of the garbage stream and actually use it? Glass recycling is pretty common now, but it wasn't back then. And one of the ideas that we had was to sort of take the glass, crush it into a very fine powder, and mix it with concrete. And glass, when it's crushed like that, has a chemical property that they say that it's pozzolanic, or it's a pozzolan, which means that when the glass bonds with cement or concrete, it actually strengthens the cement or concrete. It's stronger because the glass is there. It's not just a filler. It actually has this sort of chemical effect. And so we could look at areas where increased strength of concrete was important. And one of those areas was in the mining industry, where you could, when they're mining for gold, for example, they go in underground, they want to get all the gold, but they have to leave sort of pillars and sections unmined to hold the roof up so it doesn't collapse. And once they've sort of mined out those areas, they want to go back and remine the areas that they couldn't get to before. So they fill the mines with concrete and go back in. And we sort of found this method for using this glass in a way that was, taking it out of the waste stream and beneficial to another industry. But ultimately, although we got lots of funding and lots of interesting research that came out of it, the project didn't work because basically glass is produced in large quantities in cities. And the mines where the cement with the glass in it is needed are far from cities. And so the transportation costs just made it impossible to sort of come up with a business model that functioned well in that space. So the business failed, but the lessons learned out of that were really interesting. And they included things like there are interesting ways to research our waste stream. And there's a lot of things going into our waste stream that are potentially useful for other industries. We also can learn things like the fact that industries that we might consider to be pretty dirty or pretty unfriendly from an environmental perspective, like mining, are actually looking for ways to sort of improve their operations and have a better environmental performance. We can learn things like, how to raise funds, or how to sort of structure a company, or how to kind of hire your first employees through a project like that. So even though the company itself wasn't really successful, the individual lessons that I was able to learn and then apply to future projects were really important. And so a lot of what I talk about with students in this green entrepreneurship space is, get out there and start doing some of these things. It doesn't matter if the first venture doesn't work out or the second venture isn't a huge success. The lessons you're learning will be able to be applied in really interesting ways, and not just to other business ventures. So one of the things that I felt that I really learned through those early entrepreneurship efforts were how to kind of mobilize people in support of a big idea. And at the same time that I was failing with that mining glass recycling startup, I actually launched a national student environmental organization in Canada that linked universities across the country for the first time to work together on environmental issues. And it was the skills that I was learning in that entrepreneurship space that actually allowed me to build that successful structure in the voluntary space, or in the activist space, by bringing together students from across the country. So a lot of the ideas that I like exploring with young people are that notion of let's think about the skills that we need, how we can build those skills, and how we can mobilize them quickly in support of the environmental challenges that we're facing.
Definitely. So one thing that I've noticed is that young people seem to be afraid of failure, and we see that as like a primary barrier or obstacle. So what do you see as other primary barriers or obstacles that young people face when they're trying to enter this field of environmental entrepreneurship? And like, what strategies do you think they can employ to overcome these challenges?
Yeah, let me tackle that in two parts. Maybe I'll talk about that fear of failure first, and then sort of think more broadly about challenges for young people. But the fear of failure is an important one to think about. I think that we teach young people to be afraid of failure, and that's partly related to how we do schooling, right? Like, it's a big problem if you fail your exam, or if you fail a year at school or something like that. And I agree that that's not something we want to fail at, but we sort of build this absolute fear of failure, which is based in that understanding of kind of academic or school-related performance, rather than sort of saying, well, it's important not to fail in school, but you have to take risks and try things in other places. Entrepreneurship is really all about risk, and risk means there is a high, I don't want to say probability, but a high percentage opportunity for failure. And so failure is kind of built into the whole entrepreneurship approach to things. There's a chamber of commerce down in Charlotte, North Carolina that holds an annual fail fest where they celebrate local entrepreneurs and businesses that have failed because they sort of recognize that if people are afraid of failure, they may also be afraid to try new things. And so, I think one of the things that entrepreneurship can teach us that academics and school can't is that failure can be okay in some instances, but sometimes not trying is worse than failing itself. So I do like the fact that you picked up on that notion of fear of failure. But I think there's other barriers for young people too. Some of them are kind of, systemic. I think a lot of politicians, a lot of decision makers kind of dismiss the perspectives of young people. You hear things like, well, great message. I appreciate you putting your work into that. And don't worry, someday you'll inherit the earth. Someday you'll be able to make the decisions around this. And I always say that's a way of trying to shut young people down and keep them out of the system, right? Like, young people are citizens of the planet now. They're participants in, global life and global realities today. It's not something that's going to happen somewhere down the road. And in many countries around the world, young people form the majority of the population, right? It's this sense that saying someday you'll inherit the earth is a way of trying to exclude young people from political power and political decision making. And that one always ticks me off, but it is a sign that sometimes the systems that we've set up themselves are set up in a way that tries to keep young people out. And I think a similar thing can happen when, in the entrepreneurial context, when we talk about young people starting ventures, and needing to get access to financing or to other resources, or even not in the entrepreneurship space, but say you're starting an environmental club at your school or in your neighborhood, finding, some funding or some resources to make that happen can be difficult. And so I think that we do exclude young people from financial systems a little bit as well. And then I think the other place that we sort of make it difficult for young people to progress is that we place a lot of unrealistic expectations on the environmental sector in particular about needing to have high levels of expertise. Often we're dealing with kind of ecological, scientific, engineering related issues. And we sort of say, well, because you haven't finished your university studies yet, or because you haven't done this, or you haven't done that, you're not really qualified to talk about these issues. And again, I think when we say that, we're really sort of suggesting that, I don't know, 90% of the planet isn't allowed to talk about certain things. And I guess I'm a little bit more open in the way that I think that we need to tackle these. That Goal 17 of the Sustainable Development Goals is about creating partnerships in support of the goals. And I think sometimes we just sort of think that that's that's like sitting around the campfire singing Kumbaya, that, oh, great partnerships, we should all just work together. But I think Goal 17 is really about saying everybody has something important to bring to these issues and to these challenges, and that everybody needs to be a part of the discussion. And we shouldn't be excluding anybody on the basis of, a lack of technical knowledge or technical expertise. We can learn those things as we go and as we work on these problems. And young people in particular, are like sponges for knowledge and information, right? So I'm always sort of the opinion that, get young people involved. They'll pick up the knowledge they need as they go along. It's not something that should be used as a sort of a membership standard or some sort of gatekeeper approach to say, well, you haven't got that knowledge yet, so you're not allowed to talk about these issues. And I think if we were more open, if we were more partnership oriented, if we really thought about what things like Goal 17 mean, we'd create much bigger spaces and much more important spaces for young people in addressing these kinds of issues.
Yeah, I think pretty good quote that actually summarizes what the first half of what you're talking about is the famous quote from Wayne Gretzky, who said that you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. If you don't try, then how are you gonna know whether you failed or succeeded? Like, you need to try in order to see actually gonna succeed. Like, if you don't try, then You'll never know. And question for you is what, how do you see the future for the intersection of entrepreneurship, innovation, and environmental sustainability? And you talk about economic issues. So how can we ensure that the primary financial and regulatory barriers when we try to implement these sustainable development goals are actually resolved?
Great question, Shrey. And let me start by saying that, when you quote Wayne Gretzky to a Canadian, I'm going to be completely on board right from the outset. So it's a perfect example. And even back to the notion we were talking earlier about the fear of failure, Wayne Gretzky didn't make 100% of the shots. He took 100, not every shot that he took was a goal, but it was that notion that, yeah, if you take the shots, you will get goals. And I think that's sort of the theme that keeps popping up in our discussion today. The broader question of sort of entrepreneurship and the SDGs and overcoming some of these barriers. There's a famous economist. He was an Austrian guy who was writing in the 1930s and 1940s. His name was Joseph Schumpeter. His most famous book was called Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. And I sort of think, like, with a title like that, that book's about everything, right? So you could fit just about anything into it. But one of the ideas that he came up with in that book was a concept that economists still talk about called creative destruction, which kind of sounds like this strange sort of contradictory thing. But, he sort of said, if you look at the typical community, the typical town or city or whatever, at any given moment, there are businesses that are failing. Right? They're ceasing to operate, they're losing their sales, they're laying off workers, they're closing their doors, they're going out of business, they're going bankrupt. There's always some number of businesses that are failing. That's the destruction in creative destruction. But he says at the same time that that's happening, there are new businesses starting up, new ventures, new entrepreneurial approaches, new people hiring for new jobs, and that's the creative side. So there's this kind of economic churn or upheaval going on in communities where creation and destruction are happening at the same time. And he says that, the healthiest communities are the ones that have a lot of that kind of churn. And while it's not good, it can be really painful for a business to go to business and people to lose their jobs and that sort of thing. Without that, you don't have the opportunity to create something new and often something better. And I think for me, that's one of the key sort of issues in green entrepreneurship is if we have problems with the way the economy has worked in the past, we're too reliant on carbon, we pollute too much, we're too ingrained in this kind of planned obsolescence where everything we use breaks down after 3 years and there's no ability to kind of fix it or recycle it or anything like this. If all of those business systems that we've put in place are bad, then let's destroy them. Let's think about creating new ventures that take us in new and more positive directions. And Schumpeter's work on creative destruction basically tells us how that can happen. And so it suggests to me that with many of the issues we face on the environmental front, not all of them, that entrepreneurship becomes one of the key goal or key tools for getting solutions out there. If we have problems around things like access to clean water, which is central to one of the goals, how are we going to give people access to clean water? Well, some of the solutions in that space probably relate to new water treatment technologies, and entrepreneurship might be the fastest and most effective way to get those tools out to people that need them. Or we think about something like green energy, right? To produce green energy, we need new kinds of technologies that are capable of generating energy that has low or no carbon footprint. And how are we going to do that? Well, we're going to invent new technologies, and we probably will use entrepreneurial structures to get those out to the places that they're needed as quickly as we can. So I think that part of what the SDGs do for the entrepreneurship space is they create this kind of business case for saying there's a global demand for new ideas and new solutions. We know that that quest for creating new ventures is going to destroy some of the old ventures that are out there. And the communities and the countries and the regions of the world that are successful are the ones that are going to be able to create the most of these new kinds of greener, more sustainable, more positive ventures. And so when it comes to things like financing of new businesses, when it comes to access to capital, when it comes to mentoring and peer support, and even government support programs. Those green ventures are the ones that are going to be prioritized in those systems and are the ones that are most likely to succeed in that context of creative destruction. So I often sort of feel like, helping people understand that notion that creation and destruction happen at the same time is really important. Sometimes we hear when we talk about decarbonization of the economy, let's move away from fossil fuels. Sometimes we hear about the idea of what's called a just transition. And that's really the concept of creative destruction as well. If we move away from traditional fossil fuels, there's lots of people in those fossil fuel industries that are going to be hurt by that process. They could lose jobs, they could lose income, they could face more insecurity. So we have to make sure that at the same time we're destroying some of those traditional industries, we're creating new ones that provide new opportunities for the people that are being displaced from the old ones. That sense of justice as part of the transition of fairness and equity and new opportunities is just as important to kind of addressing these issues as kind of phasing out the old ways of doing things. And I think that's an important lesson for entrepreneurs to kind of bring to the table that yes, we are talking about the way our economy works needing to change. This kind of move away from fossil fuels is something that's really important for us. But when we do that, we have to do it at the same time as we create opportunities for people who are displaced in those industries. Otherwise, we're just asking, certain segments of the population to kind of suck it up and take it on the chin for the benefit of everybody else. Only if we can sort of propose that sort of just transition, can we really kind of convince people that this is a direction to go in.
I totally agree with your stance that developing innovation for new sustainable solutions is currently the most necessary thing we need to do to be while times are changing. And I've noticed you were deeply involved in a project focused on nurturing greener youth-led innovation and entrepreneurship for sustainable development, which culminated in a white paper that was launched at COP28 in the United Arab Emirates. So, could you share with us kind of like the journey of creating this paper?
Yeah, there's a long history to it, and it starts. You might be familiar with. I guess nowadays it's called USMCA, but basically the free trade agreement between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. When that was first signed in the mid 1990s, there were a series of environmental side agreements that went along with it. So environmental agreements between the three North American governments. And they created an organization called the Commission for Environmental Cooperation, or CEC, to kind of oversee those environmental agreements. And a couple of years ago, the CEC came to me and said, we see you're doing some stuff on green entrepreneurship at the University of Waterloo in Canada, and we know there's similar programs at universities, all across Canada and the USA and Mexico. We'd like to create a network to kind of explore how we can support green entrepreneurs a little bit better and share best practices across the three countries. So this white paper that you're discussing sort of came about because the CEC basically said, hey, let's get universities to start talking to each other and start working together on these kinds of issues. And through that initiative, I was able to meet, folks at universities all across North America. But in particular, I think at Columbia University in New York, at Rutgers, there in New Jersey, our University of Waterloo in Canada, and Tec de Monterrey, which is in Mexico, we were able to put together a group that began to kind of think about not just kind of sharing best practices and information, but maybe getting more resources out to universities to sort of work in this space. And the white paper that you're mentioning was sort of focused on this notion of how do universities actually support and encourage green entrepreneurship amongst their students. And not just universities, we're looking at high schools and this as well, but the education system becomes a way for preparing young people to think about the entrepreneurship and innovation opportunities that exist in the environmental space. So I think we do a great job of telling everybody and teaching everybody that there's big environmental problems out there. we don't necessarily do as good a job at teaching how to kind of go about finding solutions. And so we kind of lump this under the label of fostering youth innovation. How do we use education as a way of giving young people the tools to make a difference in these spaces? And the white paper, a white paper is basically a document or a paper that's designed to go to government and to decision makers to help them understand, creative approaches to an issue. So if education is a potential way of giving young people skills in this space, how can school boards, how can government, how can other public institutions kind of help the educational space play that role more effectively? And even though we sort of did this initially with a focus on North America, this has started to catch on. People are sort of excited about this idea. And so this led to that white paper, sort of being launched at COP28, the Global Climate Conference in Dubai in December of last year. Basically, countries all around the world are saying, hey, we're struggling with the same issue. How do we give skills to young people to address these issues? And so if you've got a white paper in North America, let's hear about it and talk about it globally. And I'll say that from that initial white paper, a whole lot of other things have sort of started to unfold. At the University of Waterloo, we're looking at trying to create a toolkit for young people that they'd be able to access, online to think about sort of building their skills in this space. And we're looking at things like, if we need mentoring and sort of access to funding and access to information as key things that young people need to work effectively in this space, how do we create AI tools that could be accessed online to help link young people to those sorts of resources? We're now hard at work on an academic paper, which sounds a little dry and boring, but again, we're talking to universities about this stuff. So we're looking at an academic paper focused on the same sorts of issues to sort of suggest to university professors around the world that they need to be changing the way they teach to think about some of these issues and to incorporate some of these strategies into their classes and their classrooms as they work on things. And so that basic idea of, hey, let's get together and write a white paper is really starting to kind of grow in a whole series of different directions. And I have to sort of flag a couple of real leaders in that space. Columbia University and Rutgers University have been amazing to work with and really seem to be doing some interesting things around the white paper itself, but just in this kind of youth leadership space in general.
You talked about, how you need to have this collaboration between universities and high schools and different organizations in order to actually be able to implement this and to kind of spread this farther out and spread this across the continent and maybe through even throughout the world. So on this topic of high schools and universities and especially youth leadership, so a lot of youth don't really know too much about sustainability. So how do you believe today's youth can actually play a role in driving sustainable development and environmental leadership, especially in regards to the white paper and what it kind of talks about?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of ways to sort of look at that. And one is if we think of innovation in the entrepreneurship case, and I keep going back to entrepreneurship because, that's when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I'm the entrepreneur, so I always love talking about entrepreneurship. If young people have interesting ideas about sort of addressing or solving environmental challenges, where do they go to nurture and expand and explore those ideas in an effective way? And once you get to universities, there are often structures typically called incubators. Sometimes they're called accelerators or generators, but these are kind of places where small startups and new entrepreneurs can kind of go to get support and guidance and try to launch their business ventures. And so one of the things we talk about in the white paper is, where are the great examples of this? How do you kind of tap into and access the power of these incubation systems to kind of unleash an emerging generation of green entrepreneurs? And so, there's a technical aspect to that. It's sort of How do we train the people who run the incubators to know about green businesses and green ventures in particular? How do we show them that sustainability needs to be sort of an important aspect of all their operations? We've built lots of incubators that, are thinking about the tech sector or thinking about, sort of engineering and digital spaces and software development and these sorts of things. But we haven't been so good at kind of building structures that think about sustainability. So there's an avenue or a pathway within the white paper and the work that's coming out of it that sort of speaks to that incubation space specifically. And there's some really interesting companies that are starting to come out. I just think about the companies that I've been working with. I've got a young entrepreneur named Gabriel Saunders, who's actually, he lives in the Turks and Caicos Islands in the Caribbean. He has developed this, essentially he's engineered a bacteria that eats plastic and secretes water. So we can kind of take plastic out of the waste stream and we end up with sort of no negative sort of environmental side effects. I have a group of students that I've worked with that developed a bacteria that basically it eats pollution and then dies and becomes a form of artificial leather. It's really sort of vegan leather in a way. I've got another group that has been using satellite technology to monitor the heat of forest land. So when you go in and reforest an area that's been cut down or destroyed in a forest fire, you plant new trees, you want that new forest to be healthy. And one of the ways to determine whether it's healthy is to measure the heat levels that distressed, diseased, dying trees often emit higher levels of heat than healthy trees. And so you don't have to go in and do all kinds of testing. You can now monitor from space whether a section of forest is healthy or not. And I think about these are all sort of great examples of specific things that young people that I'm working with have been able to kind of do, and that incubators have allowed to sort of help to happen in some really interesting ways. That there's these pathways for youth that are already thinking entrepreneurially, that are applying their skills, and we need to strengthen those pathways. But I think the other part of your question is, well, I didn't, what is the young person who says, I didn't invent a bacteria that eats plastic or turns into leather, or I haven't, worked with a satellite to measure, the heat of forests or things like that. Like, what do I do? How do I start to think about these issues? Because it seems so far away from my day-to-day life. And I think that that's where a whole other set of issues starts to come in. That young people are often kind of exposed to and dealing with environmental issues without even necessarily thinking of them in that ecological context. So we often we talk about concepts like environmental racism. Why are some sections of our cities and communities more polluted than others? And why does that sometimes happen in a racialized context? Or we think about things like, why are some people kind of living in higher levels of poverty than others? And there are SDGs that sort of start to speak to these issues around things like higher levels of equality and lower levels of poverty. And so I think that a lot of young people are concerned about and thinking about and confronting aspects of sustainability that they just don't think about as sustainability issues. They think about it as an issue of racism or an issue of poverty or an issue of access to resources or things like that. And one of the things that the SDGs do is to allow us to start to understand that when young people are confronting those issues or challenging those issues, that they're actually working in the sustainability space. And a lot of young people don't know they're working on environmental issues, even when they are. And I think that, maybe one of the things we could be a little better at is sort of connecting those dots. And the white paper says, let's start to use the classroom as a way to talk more creatively about some of these issues and sort of make sure that young people understand the environmental component or the environmental dynamic of what's going on. And I think, connecting some of the dots on this, the discussion of environmental racism, for example, connects back to a lot of work that the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States, is doing. The current administrator of the EPA, Administrator Regan, comes out of North Carolina. He's very interested in environmental racism issues, and he's hosting a meeting in Wilmington, North Carolina in June with the CEC that I mentioned before, which is going to be looking at issues of environmental racism and inviting young leaders in that space from all across North America to come together and kind of share ideas about what could be done in that work. And so, in my mind, the things that are spinning out of the white paper are really sort of allowing us to kind of build new partnerships around some of these issues that we've kind of been talking about a little bit, but we haven't necessarily kind of taken to the extent that we should.
So as we conclude our discussion, I'd like to ask one final question. What definitive actions do you believe governments and policymakers must prioritize to catalyze lasting changes? Additionally, how can citizens like us effectively advocate and contribute to these policies?
Yeah, so great question, Ishan. Sort of two aspects to that, I guess, as I sort of think about it. One is, government and the big systems, what should they be doing? And the second is sort of, as individuals and for you as young people, what should we be doing, at that level? So I think part of the answer for government is, get out of the way. Stop telling us that, someday we'll inherit the earth or that, when we really understand these issues, we'll be allowed to kind of take part in these discussions. I think that that does a disservice to the ability and the potential for young people to affect change today. And so I think that government should be more consciously thinking about all of the programs, all of the systems, all of the structures they already operate, how do they more effectively open those up for young people to access, right? How do they sort of make sure that young people have pathways to those bureaucratic and institutional tools that they're kind of excluded from to some extent? So that's got to, that requires a bit of a change in the way government thinks about young people and the role of young people. For young people, I sort of take the opposite approach, and I'd go back to, I've mentioned the work of Mansur Olson on big groups versus small groups. If we recognize the power of small groups, I think that's an important idea for young people because young people live in small groups, right? Like you're at a particular high school, you're at a particular college or university, you're in a particular youth organization, and that means that you're not everywhere doing everything all at once. You're not necessarily in the big group. But you're really ideally positioned to make and mobilize small groups. And if Olson's right in this research that says that small groups are more effective than big groups, that's a sort of a powerful idea. That the kind of the club of 15 people at my high school or 30 people at my university can be an effective player in this space and on these issues. I think that's a really powerful lesson. That I don't need to wait till I have 30,000 members to do something, that having 30 is enough to get started and maybe even enough to do some really interesting things. So I would say, take that lesson of the small group, get out there, get active, start doing some things. Don't be afraid of failing on the first couple of things you do. If you're going to fail, fail fast and then move on to the next thing with the skills and ideas that you've learned. But ultimately, those small efforts will be successful, and that, if millions of young people around the world are all doing small things with small successes, that's going to add up to a heck of a lot. This may be a bit of a longer answer than you wanted, but it always makes me think when I first started at the UN, we were sort of starting to talk about climate change and some of the potential solutions, and there was a group of folks there that said, well, if we engineered our way into climate change, maybe we can engineer our way out of it. So, if industry and science and technology and all this stuff sort of created the challenges of climate change, then maybe they can solve it too. And we sort of started to, assign working groups and ask scientists and researchers around the world to kind of think about potential solutions to the climate challenge. And these researchers were kind of coming back to the UN with suggestions of how we could reverse climate change. And I remember in the early days, some of the things, there was a group that came back and said, hey, if we took every airplane in the world and put machines on the wings of those planes that spit out soot and dust, we'd have all these extra particles in the atmosphere, and that would, bounce some of the sun's rays back out of the atmosphere and therefore cool the planet down. And a second group came along and said, I don't know, soot machines on the wings of every airplane in the world, that seems a bit excessive. What if we just built some giant cannons and shot that soot into the atmosphere without the airplanes? That would be great. And a third group came along and said, I don't know, the airplanes and soot machines and giant cannons, why don't we just detonate a string of volcanoes around the world all at once? And a final group sort of came in and said, I don't know, volcanoes and airplanes and soot machines and cannons, this is crazy. Let's just build a giant shield in space that blocks the sun's rays before they reach the planet. Right? And these ideas were sort of getting more and more out there and more fantastic and more expensive. And at the same time that this was happening, the headquarters of the UN Environment Program where I was working, where all these reports were coming in, was in Nairobi, in Kenya, in East Africa. And at the same time that this was happening, there was a woman in Kenya. Her name was Wangari Maathai. And she started to notice that in her village, it was getting hotter and drier. They were seeing the effects of climate change. And so she started an organization called the Green Belt Movement. And this was basically just a collection of women in her village and a few neighboring villages. And the idea they had was to plant trees, because if they planted trees, they'd have more shade. They might cool things down a little in their villages. You know, as they got more into it, then they started to understand that, you know, well, planting trees also absorbs carbon from the atmosphere, this sort of thing. But it was this small scale notion of let's plant trees in our village. But within a few years, the Green Belt movement had grown. It had expanded all across Africa. They ended up planting more than 1 billion trees. They actually impacted the climate of many of the regions that they were planting trees in. They were successful at sort of addressing this climate change challenge. Wangari Maathai eventually won the Nobel Peace Prize for her work. And the solution to this climate issue was not shields in space and you know, the technology that all of the experts were sort of pointing to. It was a small group of women from a village in Africa that came up with something really effective. That to me is the classic example of how small groups can be successful and how one or two people working just at the very local level can have transformative impacts on some of these issues. We don't need to build shields in space if we can find solutions in our individual communities that have real impacts. And the cumulative impact of many, many, many of those small changes happening all the way around the world is what we're really looking for through the Sustainable Development Goals. There's no magic wand for us in this space. There's no way we can just say, oh, I did this and that problem's solved. It's going to require millions of little solutions. And I think that young people are as capable as coming up with those little solutions as anybody else.
Yeah, it's really important that we start to create change, and we're seeing a lot of small scale initiatives to accomplish this, and we're even starting to see that cumulative impact that you're talking about. Well, Brock, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have left for today. Thank you so much for sharing your insights and experiences with us. It's been truly fascinating to hear about your work in green entrepreneurship and youth-led innovation.
That's awesome. And I'll just say in conclusion, Ishan, Ishan, and Nishrei, that you know, I've enjoyed being here, but this podcast too is one of those small solutions. So keep up the great work that you're doing, and it was a pleasure to join you today.
Thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Goodbye.